Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the NBL Pocket Podcast. My guest this week is Josh Boone of the Illawarra Hawks and formerly Melbourne United. I really love this conversation. I didn't intend for this, but this interview turned from Josh Boone and I talking about his role in last season into a breakdown of the league, the teams, players, almost as if we were commentators with no allegiances. Josh is a really straight shooter, and you'll definitely see that. Josh studied psychology at college and presumably elsewhere too, and it shows. He's got a really abstract and thoughtful mind, plus he's pretty damn perceptive too, which is good. We talk about books at the top of this interview, but if you at home are in need of a good book, be it about basketball, sports, or just to read in general, head over to booktopia.com.au. Use the link in the description to help the show. I'm reading a great book at the minute entitled The Soul of Basketball by Ian Thompson about the Heat and Mavs NBA series from, I want to say, 2006, something like that, when LeBron had first joined the Heat and coming up against Dirk Nowitzki. It's a fantastic book. It's funny, there is a bunch of NBA and basketball content out there, be it something as simple as tweets or YouTube or Facebook or Instagram, but I think the best of it is in these books. And I think it's because, and it's quite a predictable thing, I think it's because with books there's the need to put in there content that is lasting so that it will sell beyond a week or so that it's on the shelf. It has to have a real life, and you can pick up most of these books and they read as well today as they do about stuff that happened 10 years ago. Fantastic. Also, I did an episode of Keep Practicing with Andrew Kenyon. That one is a really beautiful and charming podcast, and I really enjoyed doing it, and I think you would enjoy listening to it. Most recently, Andrew did an episode on that show with his young son where they spoke about racism and the Black Lives Matter movement and how it relates to them. It was a really super simple episode and relaxing, and I really enjoyed it. I'd listen to those episodes over the one I feature on, but do as you feel. That's Keep Practicing. Search it into Apple Podcasts, Spotify. It's everywhere. If you're bored out there and want to talk about the NBL or even appear on the show with a question or an idea, get in touch on the NBLPP hotline, NBL Pocket Podcast hotline, 0499-396-818. I think that could be a lot of fun if you're interested. This interview with Josh Boone was recorded over Zoom. There are a few minor dips in the quality, but very few, and I clipped them out. So if you have any, please persist. But for the most part, it's very good. We talk about so much. Illawarra's pitch to Josh in the off-season or pre-season of NBL 20. Brooks and Dech, Brooke and Sunday Dech getting into it in practice. The departure from Melbourne, Kansas volatility and how the Hawks were able to beat them three times last season. The import and wage cuts and Josh's relationship with that. And then, of course, Black Lives Matter and how it pertains to Josh and his life and his life in Australia. Not to mention free throws and cheeseburgers. Talk about a lot of stuff. It's over an hour. I've spoken too much already. Without further delay, this is Josh Boone.
I want to start with books. I think it was on a podcast you did recently for an Australian outlet. I think it was the Post Moves podcast. You were talking about how you're a small towns guy. When you say small towns, are you talking, you know, log fires and fishing, like Walden Pond? If you know Walden, I don't know if you know that book. Are we talking that sort of small town, really off-grid, or are we talking like Wollongong versus Sydney small town kind of thing?
Yeah, Wollongong versus Sydney, and actually smaller than Wollongong. The place that I grew up in Maryland is considerably smaller and a bit less built up than Wollongong. We have a much smaller city center. You know, Wollongong, you have pretty much everything you need. In my town in Mount Airy, you know, we didn't have like a mall or anything like that. You had to actually like leave the town to go to places like that. But it's not like it was, you know, on a farm by itself, right. Although there was a farm about a mile down the road from me. I used to hear the cows every morning when I come outside.
Right. I thought maybe you had that impression. Have you read that book, Walden?
It rings a bell. I don't know if I've actually read it or not, but I do recognize the name and the premise of it, yeah.
I think it's located somewhere in Massachusetts, but nonetheless. My question then is, I've got Booktopia. They're a sponsor of the podcast. They're a, you know, bookstore, online bookstore. Are you a big reader or a reader at all? What do you like to read, books or authors?
I'm honestly not that big of a reader. You know, usually I find myself on YouTube more than reading. Right. I don't actually, I'm I'm watching a lot of random stuff on YouTube, though. Like, I have some other interests outside of basketball. You know, I'm very into video games and esports. And
all right,
there's a couple of channels that I follow that are like facts channels, where they just have like random videos that are facts. Or, you know, there's one called Ribble that I was actually just watching a video on, and it was it was about something to do with terraforming Mars. So, you know, just kind of random stuff like that,
right,
is what I.
And when you say video games,
of my reading at this point, you know, really the only reading I mainly do is like auto magazines, but right, that's pretty much.
When you say video games, are you a shoot 'em up guy or a sports video game guy?
Kind of everything. Right. Kind of everything.
You haven't got a favorite?
I mean, right now I've kind of obviously been playing Call of Duty like most other basketball players and football players and whatever. New season's supposed to be coming out tomorrow, so I'm pretty excited about that. Grand Theft Auto, I started playing again.
GTA 5. You know, I just started playing that because I was like, you know, I want to feel what it's like to be outdoors again, you know, and drive around.
I really started playing it because I just needed a break from Call of Duty. I've been playing Call of Duty for months and just right, needed something else to play. So I just decided to jump back into online and call it on Grand Theft Auto.
Oh, you like the online on that? Okay. All right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like the story, but both are good. I never got the online. It's so dependent on who you're playing with, and I'm not really that, like, maybe my internet's slow. I'm always a step behind everyone, but anyway.
Yeah, well, the good thing is we have a way that we can glitch ourselves into a private lobby. So when I play, it's literally either just me or just me and my friend. That's it.
Perfect. let's talk about NBL 20. I want to rewind the clock a little bit to the end of NBL 19, the start of NBL 20. You come off an 18-10 season, I think it was, with Melbourne, which is basically top of the ladder, tied with Perth, same record.
Yep.
I forget who got better seeding. I think it was Perth. You come off a pretty close grand final series loss. Like, I think people kind of, history won't really show how close that series was. Like, obviously Perth won in Melbourne. If they'd lost that game, it was gone back. Oh, sorry, they won in Melbourne, that's gone back. That happens. Then you sign with Illawarra. Describe for me that recruiting and signing process with them. What was the contents of your exit interview with Melbourne and then the pitch from Illawarra to you?
My exit interview with Melbourne was pretty much them saying they weren't really sure which direction they were going to go, and they had some things that they needed to figure out, and that they would, you know, get in touch with me sometime soon.
That matter of fact.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, there wasn't really too much to it. It was a much less involved exit interview than I'd ever had with them before. And then as far as Illawarra goes, Flinny reached out to my agent, and I got on the phone with him, and we had a couple of really good talks. They came through with an offer and got it done. You know, I was talking to one or two other teams as well at the time, but Illawarra was the one that came through first with an offer, and it was an offer that I liked enough to take.
When they, because that happened early, it was very unique because Melbourne the year before NBL 19, like, you were signed very late, and then with Illawarra, you were signed quite early. And I found that yeah, unique. Yeah. What do you think was a big reason?
There was some contractual disputes,
right,
between a couple of players, myself included, and Melbourne that summer. So that was why it went a little bit longer than usual. It just took us a while to get to the point where, you know, the Illawarra thing, yeah, it did come up pretty early. You know, usually I'm not signed that early, although, you know, the year before when I was with Melbourne, I re-signed in, like, basically as soon as free agency opened. You know, the year before we won, like after my first year, Casper and I re-signed very, very quickly that year. But yeah, with Illawarra, it did happen pretty quickly. And I kind of strung it along a little bit just to, you know, make sure I'm making the right decision. And, you know, it wasn't, you know, me trying to get more money or anything like that. It was literally just, I needed to make sure I had all the facts. I knew exactly what the situation was. I had enough talks with Flinny. I had enough talks with any of the other teams to make sure that I knew I was making the right decision. You know, I don't jump to decisions. That's something that I've worked on over the last several years, and now I've been doing this for 13 years. So,
right.
You know, I pretty much know what I'm doing at this point.
The thing that kind of surprised me was like Illawarra had AJ Ogilvy on their books. And I thought at the start of the season, you signing them was a bit of an odd fit. Like they had a 7-footer, you're a 7-footer. Maybe that's too simplistic a view, but did you think that going into the season? And what did Illawarra say to try to, what was their game plan to you to convince you otherwise that maybe, you know, it wasn't two of the same?
Well, I do wish that I was 7 foot. I'm not even close to 7 foot, unfortunately.
All right.
Without my shoes on, I'm not even 6'8". But
for really? Some,
you know, people don't realize that because I play a lot bigger than I am. Yeah, I didn't know that.
Nor did I think that. I don't really even look at the what's written in the dialogue in the catalog sometimes. By my eye, I always thought you're 7 foot, but there you go.
No. With my shoes on, the highest I've ever measured is 6'9". And that's with I'm a bit undersized. I've always been undersized for the position that I play.
Right.
But really the talk was we were gonna play together. And it was something that you saw at the beginning of the year, and you saw it at various stages throughout the year with AJ and myself playing together. I think there are teams in the NBL that have shown that two legitimate big men works. You look at Brisbane this year, and a lot of the portion of this year, they played Neil Magny and they played Matt Hodgson together. They started together for a lot of the year. In the beginning of the year, in the preseason, we had some success with myself and AJ starting. We beat Perth in the preseason.
Yeah, I remember.
And showed that, you know, we could be on the court together. You know, obviously things changed as the year went on. And he, you know, Flinny kind of went away from that for various reasons. But occasionally you saw it pop up throughout the rest of the year here and there.
That was my next question. Like, do you think it went to plan, the two of you playing together? If so, why not?
Well,
and your minutes went up and down like a yo-yo. Like injuries had a thing to play.
Based on the fact that most of the season we didn't play together, I would say no, it didn't go to as planned because, you know, the plan was for us to play a significant portion together. Yeah. But you know, things change in this game all the time. You know, it's always a very fluid situation when you're talking about basketball lineups for the most part. You know, Perth is an exception, but. You know, you look at every other team, and they're making tons of changes to their starting lineups throughout the year.
I had a question here that started off with 7-footers, so I'll have to change that. But bigs, right? There's a huge conversation in the game now where, like, what is the place of bigs? We've seen, like, more and more sort of positionless basketball, more outside stuff. Most bigs now are stepping outside. Even in – that's NBA, that's NBL, that's a lot of places. What do you think the secret is – for a big, regardless of whether they're 7 foot or not, to stay on the floor? You know, like what do you think, if they're not going to shoot threes, like how do you kind of, you know what I mean? Like how does a big stay on the floor in modern basketball?
I mean, up until the last several years, the traditional big man is someone who can score inside, gets rebounds, block shots, and set screens. You know, that's what a big is supposed to do. And that's what most of these guys that have begun to step out, most of them are capable of doing that, you know, maybe to a lesser extent, but they make up for it by their shooting. That's, you know, it's always been the key for me. You know, I've always been a good athlete in terms of big men, so I've always gotten up and down the floor
Lob
quicker than the majority of bigs that I play against. I've always been a defensive player first and been a very good offensive rebounder. Those are the things that have kind of, you know, helped me through my career. And then I've made range jump shots to my game. I've added some post stuff to my game when I actually get the ball in the post. So, you know.
Do you think the game's gone away from that post up stuff? Like I like the pace of a game when occasionally it's thrown down there and you let a guy work, and maybe especially when there's a mismatch.
I think the NBA game has gone away from it more than the European or Australian game. I think the Australian game, for the most part, you still have a legitimate big playing the five spot. You know, you look at our team, we had AJ and myself. You look at Sydney, you got Andrew Bogut. You look at Brisbane, you got Matt Hodgson. You look at Perth, you had
Plumlee.
What's the kid? Huh?
Miles Plumlee.
Yeah, Plumlee. Yeah. You know, you know, Adelaide, you could make an argument either way for DJ because yes, he can step out and shoot the three, but you know, really his main thing is he's a post threat. You know, he's a post presence. He's a mid post player. That's what he does the best. So, you know, really, if you're taking it team by team, really the only exception is Cam Oliver with Cans. You know, he's really the only guy that you can say couldn't really fit into that prototypical big man category, I believe. You know, he doesn't post up a lot. He tends to space the floor a bit. He's just a rim runner. Athlete. You know, what he is he's a four-man playing the five is really what he is. And not only that, he's almost an undersized four like myself. But he makes up for it by his supreme athleticism and the fact that he can shoot the ball.
The thing I find curious, though, is like even with, say, Sydney, like their crunch time lineup was predominantly Bogut off the floor. It was like kick it. Dee, Casper, Newley, Cooks. I think I'm getting that somewhere around there, but it was normally Kickett who closed games that big spot.
I think that was very situationally based. I think anytime we played them, Bogut was on the floor at the end of the game.
Yeah, I think you could be right. I'd have to double check that. That's very true. I know when Perth went to their small lineup in the finals, you know, they traditionally went with that. Say Norton, Cotton, Tirico White, Jesse Wagstaff, and K lineup. Maybe Sydney were mirroring that. Yeah,
yeah, that's a little bit different. You know, with Nick K at the five, you have to match up against him because he's such a threat on the offensive end. And you know, Andrew is a little bit slower than Nick, I think, and I guess at times they just felt more comfortable with Kicks or you know somebody else guarding him. I still think Andrew could guard him, but that was what they went to a lot of times, I guess, in the finals.
Let's change speed a little bit. What team from last season, other than the Hawks, do you feel you could have had a big impact on?
Southeast Melbourne.
You know, that was I had my own answer to the question. Yeah, well, why do you say Southeast Melbourne?
Because it almost happened.
This is what I was saying. I had a conversation with Liam San Maria.
Because it almost happened, and because they struggled at the five spot this year. You know, they had Keith Benson, and Simon was not overly, I guess, fond of him or didn't have a ton of confidence in him. So they didn't play him a whole lot. And you know, Dane, it's just lucky for them that Dane had a phenomenal year. It's funny, during the preseason, you know, they do the whole NBL fantasy thing. And I do it just for fun. Like I'll just randomly pick a lineup. I don't, you know, put any money on it or anything like that. I literally just do it for fun because I love fantasy sports. I play fantasy football at home all the time.
All right, sure.
And I actually picked Dane as my center very early, like before the season even started. And I can't remember if it was Liam or if it was another writer. It may have been another writer. They gave me a little something for picking Dane. And I said, watch, Dane is going to average 10 rebounds a game this year. And wouldn't you know what he averaged, like just over nine?
Nine and nine. Yeah, something like that. Just under double-double,
He's just a hard worker, man. He just outworks everybody. You know, I mean, hell, he had, 19 rebounds against us in a game.
Unreal. No, I loved his game. And he was a real shifter, like, on the offensive rebound. What I mean by shifter is, like, he didn't jump over guys. He didn't jump through guys. He'd just get a little bit of an early position and give guys a little bit of a shove out of the way and get a tap on it and get a rebound. I thought he was a virtuoso. I thought he was unreal. The teams I could have had, you could have had the biggest impact for me was, definitely Southeast Melbourne. I was talking about it all year. I was like, just rim protection, rim running, bit of size inside, give Dane a bit of help for sure. The other one was Perth.
Yeah, on the other account there too is I kind of played pretty well with Ty Wesley as well.
Yeah, so good point.
Yeah. <You know.
laughs> Perth Wildcats was another one. I was like, I could see you in that Plumlee role.
Yeah.
You know?
And Perth was, so, you know, we had a few conversations, but it never materialized. I like Trevor a lot. I was with him with the NBL team that went over to China that summer. Coincidentally, Matt Flynn was also with us on that trip. But you know, got to know Trevor a little bit more then, and really got to like him. I think he's a great coach, really knowledgeable guy. I can see why he's won so many championships with Perth, because you know he knows what he's doing. You know, he knows what he's doing. But yeah, they were another team that I looked at and said, yeah, you know, I could certainly be a major contributing factor on that team.
Yeah, I agree. Last offseason with Melbourne, when they kind of had that, when the season ended and then there was kind of that Sean Long signage, it seemed to be this weird cocktail of premature reporting, leaks, bad timing, social media stuff. What happened in that situation that bothered you? And if you could devise a blueprint for teams to follow so that for how that sort of departure of a player from a team plays out, like what blueprint or code of conduct would you dot out for teams so that, you know, they don't, you know, upset players on the way out? You know what I mean?
I mean, look, here was the thing about that situation. Okay. I spent 3 years with the organization. I led the league in rebounding with them. I was a first team all NBA player with them. Helped them win the championship the year before that. So, and the following year we made the grand finals again. So, you know, the way I looked at it was, I found out about the Sean Long signing from an outside source, not from them. And I hadn't actually heard from them all summer up until that point. From the time I had my exit interview until the time I discovered that they were about to sign Sean Long, I hadn't received a single phone call, text message, anything. And this is something that I've put out there already. Like, this is 100% true. You know, I didn't have any contact with them. And I just felt as though I was at least owed a phone call or a text message. You know, I understand, like, business is business. Teams, you know, make decisions based on what they think is best for their organization. And if they thought that having Sean Long instead of me was best for their organization, I'm totally fine with that. You know, I understand exactly what goes on in this business. I've done it for a long time.
Right.
But I felt as though at least I maybe deserve some kind of a phone call, like, you know, hey, we're looking at signing somebody else. Just wanted to let you know so you don't hear from somewhere else. And I would have been totally fine with that.
Right.
You know, I don't necessarily think that teams should be required to do that at all times with all players. But I do feel that in a situation like mine, where, you know, I've spent several years with the organization, helped them to you know, this greatness that we had achieved, that just a phone call. Or just a text message.
Yep.
You know, just let me know. Don't let me find out from someone else, and I'll be okay with it. That was all. Just, you know, I have no ill will towards the organization. You know, I understand they've kind of, you know, tried to backtrack a little bit and say maybe it was done the wrong way, and I appreciate that. But you know, what's done is done. I've moved on. They've moved on. You know, if they decided they wanted me back this season and the numbers were right, I would go back.
Right.
It's a bit at the end of the day. Like I said, I still, you know, like them over there. I love Dean as a coach. I really respected him. He's one of my favorite coaches I've ever had. So I have no issues with that. But yeah, that would be my answer. You know, just in a situation like this, just let me know.
Pick up the phone. I think that's across the board with everything. Like, pick up the phone. Like, stuff in, even a text, like stuff in text can so easily get misinterpreted, lost in translation. Pick up a phone call, like it's a real classy thing to do, and that's with sports teams, that's with calling your grandmother on her birthday, whatever it is. I agree. I had Lucas Walker on this podcast a little while ago, and he had sort of the opposite situation to you, where he went from in NBL 19 went from the last place Cairns Taipans to the first place Sydney Kings. You did the opposite. You went from Melbourne United to Illawarra. Serious question, like, and it might sound a bit silly question, but which season did you enjoy more?
Between my last season with Melbourne and last season with Illawarra?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's tough, honestly. You know, I really enjoyed playing with that Melbourne group. We had a great group of guys with that team. And really kept pretty much the same core for the vast majority of the time I was there. So we really got to know each other really well. You know, I have a great friendship and respect with Dave Barlow, great respect for Chris Golding. I actually didn't, you know, as most people from the outside, I didn't necessarily like Chris initially. But the more, you know, the more I got to know him, the more I came to realize that, you know, he really was at the end of the day, team first. You know, all the time, like especially during our championship run, all it wasn't, you know, I want to succeed because I want to win a championship. It was, you know, I want you to get your first championship. I want you to get another championship. I want you to experience this in your rookie year. And I think if you watch our the little video that our guy did for the season that year, you'll see him saying this. So I have great respect for him. At the same time, even though I hate losing, and losing is really tough for anybody, especially someone as competitive as me, again, we had a great group of guys with this Illawarra team. We had a bunch of young guys that were eager to learn, were working hard, were excited to be in the gym every day. And then we had some veterans that had been there, done that, you know, knew the story and were willing to kind of, you know, do everything they could to help the young guys, myself included. And then in the middle of that, you had Toddy Blanchfield, who was like, you know, didn't really fit in either category. Like, he was the only guy that we had that either wasn't 31 plus or wasn't like 2 years in the league, and that's it. It was a kind of situation, and he usually swayed toward the older guys, I think, just because, you know, he's a vet. He's been around for a while, and I have a good friendship with him as well, because, you know, obviously we played together in Melbourne my first season.
Yep.
But yeah, like, I honestly enjoyed both seasons, as tough as this last one was, between the way that the team performed and, you know, a couple of injuries that I dealt with throughout the year. I still really did enjoy it. I love playing this game. I've loved doing it for 30 years now. That's how long I've been playing basketball. Uh-huh. And the second I stop loving it is the second I'll stop playing. But so far that hasn't happened. So.
Actually, a bit of a departure. I want to talk about Casper. Like, he didn't have the great shooting year that he would have wanted. And you've played with him for a long time and him at his height. Did you see anything from the outside looking in where you're like, oh, I know how I could help Casper, or I know how we could, you know, get his shooting back up? Did you see it like that? What was your take?
Not really, no. You know, I know his numbers were down, but I think he still had a pretty damn good year, if you ask me.
I agree.
You know, I think people have made a pretty big deal about his numbers, but, you know, he's still a big shot maker. He's still one of, if not the best point guard in the entire league, in my opinion. You know, I hope that he's back next season. I know he opted out. I'm not sure if he's going to opt back in or not. You're already seeing guys opting in and opted out. You know, you look at Bryce, he signed a brand new deal. Matty Hodgson opted back in. So, you know, it wouldn't surprise me, given kind of the global climate right now, if Casper did opt back in. But I think he's going to wait and see. He's going to see what his other options are and what the money is looking like in Europe, and he's going to make an educated decision. You know, I don't know that there was anything in particular that I saw that I could say, hey, just do this. You know, I'm not a shooting coach, and Casper is a hell of a lot better shooter than I am. So that's not something that I can really coach him on. You know, right. I tend to stick in my lane. I know what I'm good at, and, you know, deep 3-point shooting from one step inside the half court is not necessarily what I'm best at. So
sure,
but yeah, I still think he had a great year.
Sure. I think it was in a written piece by Liam San Maria, an interview with you. He wrote, in that piece, he wrote about, and it was so obvious how detailed you were about your, and how much understanding you had of your analytical impact on the team. I think in that article, and I wish I could have found it to be more specific, but you talked about like rebounding percentage, rear on the court, on-off metrics, win shares, I think was mentioned. It was portrayed as though you use that sort of stuff in contract negotiations. Do you use it to display your worth to a team, or do you do it to sort of know what you bring to a team? You know, tell me about your relationship with analytics.
I guess it's kind of both. I guess I'm always curious to know exactly what I'm doing to help a team. And numbers don't necessarily always tell the whole story. And I'm smart enough to realize that. But there are certain numbers that you can look at and say, okay, you know, this makes sense. You know, player efficiency is kind of one of those numbers that I'm a little bit iffy on, but I do believe that it does have an impact.
Why is that?
I don't know. You know, there are several things that go into player efficiency, and I don't know that they all need to be there. Another thing that is a little bit of a question for me as well is offensive and defensive rating on the court. You know, to an extent, I think you can use that as a solid metric, but at the same time, you know, the plus minus system, especially, like, there are guys that could have a very low plus minus, but they're actually giving a lot to the team. It just so happens that they're on the court during, you know, these runs that happen during the game, and it's not really anything to do with them. They just happen to be on the court at the time. So yeah. Plus minus is a really tough thing for me to really say, you know, that really, really matters. Like, I don't, unless it's like outrageous. Like, if a guy is like, you know, plus 400 or something throughout the course of 20 games, then you look at it and say, okay, this is probably pretty damn accurate. He needs to get more playing time. But, you know, if you're hovering around that middle zone, I think it's a pretty big question in my mind whether it really makes sense to base anything off that.
There's a podcast by a guy by the name of Ben Taylor. He's an American guy. It's called Thinking Basketball. He had an episode called Should the Board Man Get Paid? You know, because long time it's been like the board man gets paid, the emphasis on rebounding. He really took the emphasis away from total rebounding stats. He doesn't, you know how for the longest time, when at the end of a game, if a player's played well, it's he had 20 points, 10 rebounds, 5 assists. And he argues that sort of rebounding as a total stat is kind of, he doesn't put a lot of emphasis on it. He puts a greater emphasis on like what was the rebounding percentage when a player was on the court. And I looked at yours, your stats on both of those are quite high, your total rebounds and your sort of defensive rebounding percentage when you're on the floor. What do you think about a contention like that? Like what emphasis do you put on rebounding and rebounding stats? Like, do you think if someone's got a lot of total rebounds, that was a good game? You know what I mean? I don't know.
It's all going to depend on the game. And kind of how they're getting the rebounds. You know, I do think it's a pretty big stat. I think, there are occasions where I've had 7 offensive rebounds in a game, but they've only actually translated to 4 points because several of them were, you know, maybe tips that I missed or something like that. In those cases, it doesn't matter nearly as much. But you see a guy with, you know, like Andrew Bogut, you take him as an example. You see he gets, you know, 7 defensive rebounds a game. That's a pretty big number. And right. Yes, Sidney's whole rebounding scheme is based on him getting the rebound.
Yeah.
But that's still a very big number. And that's absolutely something you have to pay attention to and take into account. You know, I think just as with a lot of these stats, it's situationally based. I think for the most part, though, I do believe that it matters.
I'd love to see a stat come in contested rebounds. So rebounds, and obviously you have to have people judging that. Am I still with you? It says the connection's a bit iffy, but I'll keep going. Contested rebounds. So rebounds that have come off that are either in dispute, because those rebounds to me are invaluable. Like if you don't grab a defensive rebound that's contested, that's going the other way or could be put back or whatever. That to me is a stat. I'd love to see statisticians start recording.
Yeah, but at the same time, an uncontested rebound, if you don't go and get that rebound, that means it hits the floor and who's going to beat you to it?
I'd love to see a division of the two so you can see how many uncontested rebounds, how many contested rebounds. Now, I don't know if statisticians can do that, but
most statisticians can't even get normal rebounds right. So for them to be able to get contested rebounds right as well, that's asking a whole lot.
Let's go to this. Playing with Melo, LaMelo Ball. I got 2 questions about this. Taylor Braun, you might remember the play. Taylor Braun of the Brisbane Bullets goes down twice on defense. I got 2 questions for you. LaMelo makes that dribble. He passes you the ball. You don't finish the play. I got 2 questions for you. Do you think Braun got crossed up or did he slip on the decals on the floor things? What do you think?
I think one of them he slipped on the decals. One of them he did fall, if I remember correctly. For sure, one of them, he definitely slipped on the decal. I think the other one, he might have fallen. He might have. I'd have to look at it again to know for sure.
Do you remember that play? I remember you had the stuff and it kind of rimmed out. Do you remember why you missed that one? Did you catch it wrong or something?
Of course I remember the play because every 14-year-old on Instagram wants to bring it up to me every fucking day. Sorry for cursing, but I get tired of it every now and then. So what happened on that play, and I look like an idiot because of how the play went, but in actuality, what really happened is when Melo passed me the ball and I went up for the dunk, Matty Hodgson turned around and took a swipe at it, and he actually hit me on the way up. So I, as I'm going up, I lost control of the ball, which is why I couldn't finish it and ended up just throwing it over the rim, because I literally didn't have possession of the ball when I went up. And that was why as soon as I came down and hit the floor, I looked straight at the referee because it was a blatant hit. Like he very clearly hit me. He like actually smacked down. And if you asked him, he'd probably say the same thing. And if he didn't, he's a liar. But yeah, that's what happened. But
I thought
the problem, there was no foul call. And from the angle that the video has, you can't really see it. So I just look like the worst basketball player in the world who can't even make a wide open dunk.
Because I saw the play, and you're right, the angle doesn't support, like it doesn't look like a foul, but that's not to say. Because the moment you miss it, you turn around, you look at the ref. So
yeah, I mean, look, if I missed it, then I just missed it. Yeah. But there's a reason why I went straight to the referee as soon as I got down on the rim, and that's why.
I got, speaking of LaMelo Ball, I got a lot of praise for his game. I also got my criticisms. You've played in the NBA. Is he the number one pick? Like, are his strengths going to translate? What do you think?
I think he's potentially the number one pick. Definitely should be a top three pick. Mm-hmm. I think really everything that he does well will translate to the NBA game. I think his court vision will translate greatly, especially with a more wide open floor. Mm. I believe that your biggest criticism is going to be A, his defense, and B, his shot selection.
They would be so two. The other one would be like longevity. Like he only played 12 games here. It's an 82-game schedule in the NBA, you know, and whether that was injury, whether that was, you know, a whole bunch of stuff that's going on. That'd be my three, though. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, well, you know, longevity.
Debate, yeah, who's to know?
He got injured, and there was a question as to whether he could come back or not. And, you know, they made the decision just to, you know, shut it down for the year. And I understand that. You know, he had done everything that he needed to do. He showcased everything that he needed to show, and there was no reason to risk having him get re-injured by rushing him back to a team that wasn't going to make the playoffs. Right. You know, I think if we were in a position to make the playoffs, there's potential that you may have seen him again. But I didn't really think there was like if it was me talking to him and there was still a question as to whether he could re-injure this by returning, I would have said the same thing. I'd have said, nope, just sit out. You know, you got your whole career ahead of you. There's no reason to risk a major injury right now at such a crucial stage in your career. So that's the longevity part. I think that, you know, he could have probably finished the year out at the end of the year if need be. Mm-hmm. As far as his shooting percentage goes, I think that will improve in the NBA because he will not be taking the same types of shots that he took with us. I believe that he felt that he had to score more with our team because we didn't have that many scores, and he felt the need to take it upon himself to score a bit more to try and help us. I don't think it was anything selfish. I think it was literally that he just didn't think we had enough scorers to win games. And because
was
of that
the instruction?
No, I don't believe so. I think we tried to, you know, get him to tone down a little bit some of the shots, but you know, that was just Melo being Melo. You know, but I think he will shoot the ball at a much better percentage in the NBA because he won't be taking so many shots that are potentially, you know, four shots. And especially if he gets on a guy on the team with a lot of veterans, you know, he doesn't necessarily want to score 60 points right in a game. Like, he would rather have 30 assists in a game because he loves passing and because he's great at it. So I think that's what you're going to see. And then what was the third thing?
His defense
throughout the season, his defense actually did improve our less complicated schemes defensively in the NBA. We have some pretty complicated schemes in the NBL, and we had a few with our team, with Illawarra. And when you're a young guy that's never really dealt with anything like that before, it can be daunting. You know, it can take a while to learn. And I did see over the course of the season that he began to learn it and he began to play better. And it's not even that he actually does give a fair amount of effort on defense. It's not like he just takes plays off. You know, he does actually play defense. it was just, you know, sometimes he would be out of place based on the scheme, or, you know, go for a steal that wasn't necessarily there, or maybe just fall asleep on a cut. But that's what a lot of young guys do, and it takes most players a while to really learn how to play defense. So I think he's going to be fine as far as that goes. You know, most people in the NBA don't play defense until the playoffs anyway, so he'll be fine.
That's very true. The other thing is on the John Hollinger and Nate Duncan podcast, they're NBA guys. They talked about like the circus around him as well, and how that will not necessarily whether it was present or not, but more of the fact that the threat of it, you know, like the family thing. So my kind of question to you is like that last season, or, you know, just gone, the team seemed to play a lot through LaMelo when he was there. He had a really high usage rate, you know, 7 or 8 3-point attempts a game. We've spoken about it. Was it frustrating handing over control to an 18-year-old kid? Seemingly.
Absolutely not. No. Right. I've always been someone that believes as a point guard, you run the team. Right. You control the team. You make sure everyone is in the places that they need to be at the right times. And if they're not, you make sure that you tell them where to go. And you control the pace of the game. You control the tempo of the game. I don't believe that any other player on the court can necessarily do that, because no other player on the court has the ball in their hands as much as the point guard does.
Right.
So I've always been of the belief that the point guard should run the team, and it was no different whether it was LaMelo Ball, 18 years old, whether it's Casper Ware, whether it's Jason Kidd. You know, it doesn't matter to me. And that was something that I stressed to LaMelo very early. You know, I pulled him aside several times, and I was like, look, you know, you need to learn every play from every position so that you know exactly where everyone needs to be and that you can leave them. I was like, we have no problem listening to you, following you. We just need to hear your voice. That's all it is. Right. And some things that he worked on and he got better at, and he will continue to get better at as well. But once again, you know, he's a quiet 18-year-old kid. So yeah. That's a little bit out of his, you know, normal characteristics, out of his normal personality. So it's something that he just has to work on. I was the same way. You know, when I was playing at UConn, when I was playing for the Nets, I was super quiet, never said a word to anybody. You know, now I'm cursing people out left and right. I don't care anymore. you know, I'll tell anybody, you know, where they need to be or exactly what I think of them at any given time. But I didn't used to be that way either. It took me a while to get to that point. I didn't really develop the leadership qualities until about 2014 or so, when I was playing in Bahrain. That was really when I started to develop that. And it was really only because my coach kind of forced me to do it. He was like, look, you know, you have to be the one to lead this team. They need to hear your voice. And, you know, it did nothing but help me. It helped me develop as a player, as a person. You know, the same leadership qualities that I've developed on the basketball court, I can use in real life
right,
as well.
Right. The other one I want to talk about, the other import running mate of yours was Aaron Brooks. For a while there, it was going to be you two with the imports of the Illawarra Hawks, and you're playing quite well. What's your relationship with him? Like, when you two were those two imports, your brothers in arms, he had some sort of strange moments in the preseason where he'd get called for fouls and kind of walk into the crowd and talk a bit of shit and stuff. What was he like to play with, and what was your take on that?
AB is cool, man. I love AB. AB is just, he's a very outspoken person, you know, right. When something's bothering him, usually you're probably going to know it because he's going to let you know it. You know, he's not afraid of confrontation. He's not afraid to yell at you. You know, him and Sunday, I remember, got into it during. Yeah, I said he and Sunday got into it during one practice, and you know, almost came to blows, and we had to break it up. And I'm okay with that.
That's fine.
In some instances, because sometimes you need that. You know, sometimes you need that extra edge. You know, he's just a very emotional guy. He's been that way for as long as I've seen him play. And it was something that we already knew going in. So it wasn't really anything that, you know, surprised us or anything like that. Ultimately, you know, he's not out for himself. He was still out for the team first. And he was, you know, even when he was injured and, you know, had come back home, he was still following the team. I still see him posting stuff about the Illawarra Hawks now, even after he's been gone for several years. So I think that should tell you what kind of a person he is.
The other one is, did you eat it? You know that chicken place? Is it Chico's or Chicos? Did you eat there? Did you like it?
Yeah, Chico's. Yeah, it was good. It was pretty good. It's just a like a little.
I've been there once.
Place. It was actually right around the corner from where I lived. It was, you know, 5-minute walk from there. But I think I only went there maybe 3 times the whole time I was there. But it was good. It was good.
The Foundation Club and Matthew Adepanya, who made that. I love that series, and a lot of people did.
You had
and have pretty good on-camera speaking chops. You know, you're pretty candid, pretty good on the mic. Did you enjoy being a part of that artistic process with that thing? And is commentary and sports content creation in your future?
I don't think I was overly involved with any of that. You know, there were a few episodes here or there where I made a little candid appearance, but for the most part, I think it was focused on some of the other guys a little bit more. You know, there was some stuff on Melo, there was a lot of stuff on the younger guys, which was nice to see. You know, I think they deserve that spotlight, and I think that you know, guys like Sunday, guys like Emmett, who are just kind of starting to come into their own, I think it did a great job of highlighting them and making sure that people knew, you know, what they were capable of, what they had been doing throughout the season, especially towards the end of the season for both of them. Content creation, I don't know if that's necessarily in my future. You know, my future probably holds a couple of different possibilities. You know, certainly some type of broadcast stuff would be something that I'll look into. Coaching, maybe not. I'm still kind of on the fence as far as coaching goes, to be completely honest with you. I've always thought that I know I would be a very good coach, but I've always felt that I don't want to coach anything higher than high school. But if the opportunity presented itself for something greater, then I think I would seriously look at taking it. If I'm not in basketball, I'll probably be doing something in esports, honestly. I've been throwing out a lot of feelers here and there. I've been to a couple of different esports teams, facilities to kind of check them out, and been trying to make some contacts in that field as well. It's something that interests me. And not only that, I think there's a hell of a lot of money that's going to be in that field right now and in the future.
Have you ever looked at sort of the lay of the land in either esports or just sports or basketball, and seen where, like, oh man, if I could make a show or a style of writing or a podcast, like, have you ever looked at it and thought, oh, like, there's something in media I'd like to make? Have you ever had an idea for a show or something like that?
The only thing that I did have was, and I mentioned it to somebody in the NBL once. It may have been Jeremy, but I never really brought it up again. Back when, you know, rest in peace, Kobe Bryant was doing his breakdown series. I forget what it was called. I actually mentioned to the NBL that I would love to do something like that for the NBL, because I think that's something that I would be very, very good at. Daniel Cormier does it with MMA now as well. And I think that is something that I absolutely would have enjoyed doing and would still enjoy doing if they wanted me to do it.
Right. Breakdown. So, like, looking at particular plays and stuff like that. Or, like, yep, you do a thing like how Casper gets his scores.
Players, yep.
Right. All right, Josh, I'll store that away. Speaking of the Foundation Cup, episode 10, you said you made a few pop-ups in that thing. This was one I really liked. Episode 10, it was the second win of the season over the Taipans for you guys in Cairns.
Yeah.
You had 15 points, 9 rebounds in 23 minutes. At halftime of that episode, you say, and I quote, "They're ready to quit. We make a good run in the third quarter. I can see it. They're going to quit." Take me through your impact on that game and why you said that at halftime. What gave you that feeling? And then what did you do going into that second half?
Yeah, I think I had a fairly large impact in that game. I think that was also a game that LaMelo may have had a triple-double, if I'm not mistaken. So, obviously, he played relatively well in that game. Like I said before, I've been doing this for a very long time. And not only have I been doing this for a long time, but I've also studied psychology. And, you know, there's a lot of times where I can look at, you know, a situation, whether it's on the court or whatever, and I can see exactly what's going on in people's heads. And that was one of those instances where, you know, their body language was such that they were ready to go. And, you know, with the makeup of their team at that time, I believe that if we made one more run, they weren't going to come back, and we were just gonna be able to close it out. And as you said, that was exactly what happened. You know, we put them away in that third quarter, and they never really made another major run at it, I don't think, in that game.
When you say the makeup of that team, what do you mean?
You know, they had a lot of individual personalities on that team. You know, Cam is all over the place. He's
wild,
excited, and then he's down, and then he's up, and then he's down. And, you know, you had Majuk Dang, who, you know, is known for being a bit of an emotional guy himself.
Yeah.
You know, Nate is emotional. Scott is pretty even keel, but he's really about the only one of their, you know, major players on that squad that you can say that about. So, you know, I just wanted to try and bury them right there. That was my mindset. And it was probably only half that I saw that. And the other half was I just wanted to try and motivate the guys.
Okay, sure.
You know, that was the other part of it as well. I truly did believe that if we made a run, that was going to be the end of the game.
I'm going to watch that second half again. I'm going to see where that run came and how it went down. But that Cairns team, you beat them three times last season. I mean, I forget how many wins you had total, about five games, I think. You know, yeah. Over half of them were against Cairns. They were a better team on paper, right? Charter came over that. How were you able to beat them with such regularity? Was it a game plan thing? Was it situational? How'd that go down?
The NBL is one of the only leagues that I've ever seen where matchups truly play a huge role in every game. Every year you see one or two teams that just can't beat this other team for some reason. When I was with Melbourne, the team that we always struggled with the most for no reason whatsoever was Brisbane. Brisbane always used to give us a hard time. They would beat us two or three times every single year. No matter what we did, we just always struggled with them. And I don't know what exactly it was. It was just something about their system that just clashed with ours very negatively for us. And I think it was a very similar situation with Cairns against us. It was just that matchup. There's not really any one particular thing that I can say, you know, we did this and that's why they couldn't beat us. It just happens like that in the NBL. I wish I could put my finger on exactly what it was, but I legitimately don't have a specific answer for you. You know,
so the game plan didn't differ going to play them.
Not really. No. Wow. No, you know, the game plan is a little bit different for every team, but in terms of like overarching plan, it wasn't any different for them. You know, we obviously had different schemes for Scott and for dealing with Cam, but aside from that, there wasn't a major game plan change between playing against them and playing against everybody else. It was just that matchup that wasn't favorable for them.
Curious, because it just happens so often, and it cost me a bit of money here and there as well, to be fair. End of NBL 20. We come to the end of the season. You, the Hawks, you know, surprisingly beat both Perth and Sydney last season, Perth in the preseason. Who would you have tipped to win those two remaining games and the title, and why? And did you watch the grand final?
I didn't really watch it, no. Okay. I kind of would catch bits and pieces of it here and there, but I don't think I actually sat down and watched a full game. I believe that Perth would win because I didn't think that Sydney could beat them in Perth.
Okay.
I thought that Perth's home court advantage was going to be too much.
Even without the crowd, though?
Yeah. Well, as I said, you know, before all of this happened and before they took the crowd out of the game that Sydney did actually win in Perth, I didn't believe that Sydney could win in Perth. So I believed that Perth was going to win that series before everything happened.
what about after? So if the crowd went out of it and the home court advantage went out of it, who do you favor in that instance?
Potentially Sydney.
Really?
Potentially Sydney can win that series, yeah. I thought Sydney was really good. The one thing that really changed for them between last season and this past season was their defense. Their defense was just so much better. They went from being one of the worst teams in the league defensively to one of the best teams in the league defensively. And a lot of that credit has to do with the coaching.
You didn't think Bryce Cotton was just going to lead that team?
He potentially could. Look, he was,
you like Sydney?
You know, two years MVP for a reason. Yeah. He absolutely could. But I believed that during the season, I told everyone from middle of the season on anybody that asked me, I said Perth was the best team in the league. They were the best team I had seen all year. They were consistently the best. I thought that Sydney was very good, almost to that level, but I thought that Perth was the best team in the league. I also thought that Sydney was potentially playing better going into the grand final. I thought throughout the playoff series, I thought Sydney looked better to me as I watched. And that was why I believe that Sydney could have potentially beat them in a neutral setting, neutral facility, whatever you want to call it.
Right. Okay.
But throughout the season, I did believe that Perth was the best team in the league. This is even when they went at the top of the ladder.
Right. This is a contentious question. But if the Hawks had made the grand final, and you, even if you were up 2-1 or down 2-1 in that grand final series, do you think you would have reached the same conclusion as the Kings, not the Wildcats, the Kings, and withdraw from that series, knowing what we know about coronavirus at that time? Where would your vote have been? Would you have voted to play or not play? Toughie.
I mean, I always want to play. And yes, it's huge when there's a crowd there, but I would have still wanted to finish what we started. You know, that probably would have been my vote. At the same time, if there were enough players that were against it and, you know, were worried about their health, worried about their safety, I would have no problem with that as well. I mean, all you need to look at to answer that question is the fact that I went to Dubai and was going to play on the team there amidst all this. So,
yeah, good point.
There's your answer.
Here's a question for you. We had this big vote in the NBL, like the wage cut vote and all that, right? And there's NBL delegates, two from each team. The Hawks ones are Todd Blanchfield, AJ Ogilvie. When they went to that vote that was not only about cutting wages by 50%, but also imports, slimming them from 3 down to 2, did they confer with you before going to that meeting? Did they say, like, did they get the input of their import, is my question.
No. No, I didn't have any input into that. I discovered that along with the rest of the world, I think, when the posts were made. I didn't even know that it had come up until some Instagram page had posted something.
I think you should have.
Maybe, maybe not.
Okay.
You know, I'm not, like, mad or disappointed that, you know, AJ or Toddy didn't contact me beforehand. I actually did speak to AJ throughout the process. I messaged with him a couple of times, so I knew pretty much what was going on as it was happening. I just didn't know when it started. I found out when it started through social media. But after that, I was in contact with him, but I didn't really have any, it was my place. I'm not under contract next year, so it may or may not affect me at all. You know, so that was kind of how I looked at it.
The trimming of the imports, 3 to 2, it's a tough measure for any and all imports. That's 33% less employment opportunities. What was your reaction when you heard that particular part of it?
That was a tough one, because that certainly brought my chances much lower of returning to the league, I believe.
Naturally.
You know, just being realistic. I would hope that I still have the opportunity to come back to a team, but losing that third import, you know, most teams are going to get a guard. They're going to get a point guard. And most of the teams that probably could have been potential options for me may already have somebody, or they may have a wing. Like, you know, you look at Melbourne, for example, and Casey Prather is still on the contract for next year.
Oh,
And the odds are they probably go out and get a point guard again. You know, maybe
they forgot about that. I did a podcast recently looking at them, and I forgot that Prather's on the contract. Yeah, so it's going to be Long or Trimble that goes. I mean, that's
hard. Well, it's already been decided. Sean Long signed in Korea.
Right. Yeah,
Sean's going to Korea. So, and you know, my assumption would be that Melbourne probably signs a point guard. You know, maybe they roll with Shea Illy as their starting point. I don't know. You know, I know, but if I had to guess, I would say that they probably go with a point guard. Do I hope they go with a center and decide to contact me? Of course. But being realistic with myself, most teams in this league, their number one priority,
God,
unless looking at a team like Brisbane, is an import point guard. So that's one slot right there. And then there's a couple of teams that already have that second import sign for next year, so it becomes tougher.
That was the one that that import slimming, I was like, I get why they did it. You know, imports are traditionally more expensive than locals, and it, you know, but at the same time, I was like, nah, this is, anyway, I just don't think it's a good idea. It's not a good product without three imports.
I mean, look, I wish I could be diplomatic, but I don't think it's a good idea either, you know, from both a personal perspective and from a basketball perspective. But, you know, I didn't make the decision. I respect the decision. I think Larry has done a great job with the league. I think Jeremy's done a great job as CEO of the league, and I think they'll continue to bring the league to new heights. Hopefully I can be a part of it. If I can't, then I can't, and that's just the way things go, and, you know, I'll go somewhere else next season.
This is a question I'm a bit nervous to ask, but do you think if the vote on restricting imports had come after this latest Black Lives Matter movement and all this sort of racial upheaval, do you think things could have been different? I mean, 27 of the 27 imports in the league, 24 are African-American. Could the power of public opinion have swayed something, or am I being crass or out of, you know?
I don't know. That's a really tough question.
That's loaded.
It's just a tough question to really know what the answer is, because it's purely a, you know, if this had happened, but yeah, it didn't happen. So it's one of those questions that I don't think you'll ever really have an answer to. Yeah. Potentially it could have, I think. I think there's certainly that potential, but for sure that it would have swayed it? No.
I'm hoping there's a number of measures in that agreement that allow for a renegotiation of, you know, profits are better or revenue's better than we thought, they're going to redistribute that. I'm hoping, really hoping, that they're going to see if things settle before the season, or if the season is pushed back, that maybe that import limit is looked at as again as well. I hope there's that provision. I really do.
Yeah, I hope so too. I think it would be the best thing for the league in terms of the basketball standard. But if they can't, I'm sure they'll continue to grow it and continue to get better. The locals in the Australian League are some of the best locals in the entire world. And they've proven that for the last 5-10 years now.
Let's go to something else. Free throw shooting. You shot them at 36% last season, and I'm sorry to rub it in, but that was league worst. You had players nominating you as the guy most likely to give away cheeseburgers and those, you know, Hungry Jack's ads. You saw that. What is it about free throws?
Did I give away the most cheeseburgers this year?
I don't know. I think it was Matt Hodgson.
I did not.
Who did?
And not only that, one of those guys who threw me under the bus got lucky several times this year, and I made it a point that every time he got lucky, I let him know. And that's a guy by the name of Casper Ware, because Casper missed several times on the road, two in a row, but he got lucky because someone else on his team had already missed two in a row. I think it was three games. So if it wasn't for that, I'm pretty sure Casper would have led the league in those. So I just want to make sure that that's out there. I also was not the leader in that the year before as well. I've never led the league in most cheeseburgers. I tend to shoot free throws better as the year goes on. And towards the end of the year, if you look at, you know, the last 6 or 7 games, I did shoot them better. For me, it's just more mental. Like I can shoot the ball. I've shown that I have a good jump shot. I can shoot free throws in practice. It's mainly just a mental thing once I get into the game, and it's been something that I've struggled with my whole career. Yeah. And to answer your other question, no, I'll never shoot them underhanded. You don't even need to throw that out there.
And why is that?
Because I won't. Yeah. Because I won't.
It's embarrassing. Yeah.
No, I can shoot the ball. It's fine. I experimented with a couple of different free throw mechanic type things in college, and nah, I'm good.
Malcolm, you know, Gladwell.
The thing about me is that, you know, I do tend to miss a lot of free throws. I don't miss a lot of meaningful free throws. You know, I don't miss a lot of free throws late in the game if we really need them. You know, I do tend to make them then, because I'm pretty good under pressure, you know, in the crunch time of games.
Malcolm Gladwell, maybe you've heard of him. He's a thinker and sort of a writer, author, very, very smart, very funny guy. He put out a podcast of an episode of his podcast called Revisionist History. The particular episode was entitled The Big Man Can't Shoot, in which he talks about Rick Barry, you know, who shot him underhanded. And yeah, that, so the idea of not shooting them underhanded, he puts it down to, like, his contention is that so often we put the, like, instead of looking at actual results, people look at style or, you know, their own sort of perception of themselves rather than the actual results. So my question is, if you could shoot them underhanded and hit them at 95%, would that be enough to get you to shoot it that way?
Yep. Absolutely. That is
his contention.
But I can't. I would shoot them worse than I shoot normal free throws.
Right.
So
you don't like the mechanism.
No reason to be tried. Yeah.
It is a hard shot. I've never thought, like, I don't.
Just look at it. When you look at it a little bit deeper, the reason that that comes up is at the end of the day, what are we in? We're in an entertainment industry. That is what professional sports is. It's purely an entertainment industry. So when you say, you know, a guy might not want to do this because he may not be looked at favorably, he might get made fun of, absolutely. It's entertainment.
Yeah, you know? Right.
We all have these personas that we have. We all, you know, people have these perceptions of us. Like you look at me, for example. Like, you know, when I played in Melbourne, I always had something going on with my hair. You know, I always had the different shoes or whatever, the custom shoes. Like it's all, you know, your personality that you're presenting to people in this entertainment industry. That's what it is. And again, you know, I don't think somebody would want to be looked at as, oh, that's the guy that shoots them underhanded. Yeah, you know, don't even bother with him. But yeah, if I shot them at 95%, absolutely. I would definitely shoot them. I have no problem doing that.
So your rebuttal to Malcolm Gladwell would be that free throw percentage is not necessarily the one answer. There's also the answer of, what does this do to my reputation, brand in an entertainment league, which is a fair answer. Like it has to be an aesthetics to your game as well as, you know, computable free throw stats. I understand.
I think that has to be something. You know, my game has never been overly flashy. You know, when I was a little bit younger, I was very athletic, so I did have some of those dunks and things like that. But you know, the things that I do get overlooked a lot. And the reason is because they're not flashy. They're not overly exciting. You know, I'm fighting for offensive rebounds. I'm setting really big, and it's something that people necessarily notice. And to be honest, it can be kind of frustrating because I've always felt that I've been a bit undervalued throughout my career by the people that make decisions, because I think a lot of the stuff I do just gets overlooked, you know, and look no further than the fact that Melbourne was really the first team since I played in China that I did multiple seasons with that was willing to bring me back. It wasn't for lack of production by any means. You know, if it wasn't that, then what was it?
Going back to that Melbourne team, actually, like I felt they pulled the pin on that a little too early. Like they made the grand final, played really well. You had a nice collection of imports, yourself, Casper Ware, and DJ Kennedy. And I felt like everyone was like, oh, well, they lost in the grand final, blow this up. I was like, I don't think that's a good idea. I think, like, re-tinker this, go again. Were you as disappointed as I was that you know, you didn't get a second run at the grand final? I mean, grand final runners-up, that's not like – bad teams don't do that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I was certainly disappointed. As I said, I loved playing for that team. I loved playing with those guys. And I don't know. You know, what is it really to say about it at this point? You know, the fact is we didn't get another opportunity at it. The fact is they went a different direction and they did what they thought was best for their organization. So there's not really much more I can say on it.
I'm nervous to ask you this one as well, but yeah, I think it's important to talk about Black Lives Matter and as it pertains to Australia. Have the things that people are protesting about, police brutality, institutionalized racism, have they been a part of your life, Josh? Probably that you've noticed.
Yeah. I mean, I have certainly experienced some level of racism in my lifetime. I've been
sorry to hear that.
Profiled by police a couple of times. I've never actually been arrested, but I have been, you know, profiled just purely because of the way I looked. I've been followed around in grocery stores because somebody thought I was going to steal something. Right. The one that really sticks out in my mind is when I was in prep school. The prep school that I went to in Maryland happened to be a couple of towns away from one of the former headquarters of the KKK. And to this day, there's still a very big white nationalist influence in that area. And I remember I went to the bank one day to cash a check, and I walked in the bank and I walked up to the teller, and she literally looked at me and said, "Why are you here?" So, you know, when you deal with things like that, you understand why everyone is so upset and why I'm so upset as well.
Yeah, I was about to say, where do you sit on the scale of angry and negotiating for change? I think the scale was put out there, like, where are you on the Malcolm X and Martin Luther King scale? If Martin Luther King is a 0 and Malcolm X is a 10, like, what's your angle on this?
I guess I'm probably a 4-ish. Okay. I would say I'm close to the middle. I'm more towards Martin than I am to Malcolm, I think. But I think a lot of people have reached that Malcolm stage, and I think that is absolutely understandable. The other issue is when you look at a lot of these protests, especially early on when they were happening, it wasn't necessarily the Black Lives Matter protesters that were causing the problems. It was these other groups that had kind of been injected into these protests literally to wreak havoc. And it's unfortunate because to an extent, I felt as though the message was getting lost. Now, we have already seen some significant change. You know, we've already seen the Minneapolis Police Department is being disbanded.
Community system, I saw that.
They're starting new. So,
wow.
You know, not only that, we saw the other three officers that were involved in the George Floyd incident get arrested. We saw the three men that are involved with the Ahmaud Arbery shooting getting arrested and now being charged. So you can't say as though it hasn't worked.
Yeah.
But there's still a very long way to go. There's still a lot of things that really need changing. I think it's a tough thing for our country because I think it unifies, but it also divides at the same time. Because, you know, I think the people that were, you know, pretty moderate in terms of the, you know, protest side, the pro Black Lives Matter, but I think the people that were on the other side of it before are probably keying on the negatives that have happened and are probably distancing themselves even more. And I just hope that doesn't get worse. You know, I absolutely believe in these protests. I absolutely stand with them, agree with them 100%. If there was a protest here, I would have gone to it, but there wasn't. But I just hope that it doesn't have dangerous ramifications as far as the other side goes. Right. That's all I hope. But if it does, then unfortunately, that's what has to happen sometimes for change. You know, civil war happened.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was that was necessary to get the change that people desired. Well, that, you know, a lot of people desired. Obviously, some people didn't.
A lot of them fought
with the Confederacy. Not all of them, but.
Did you see that NASCAR's banned the Confederate flag? Have you seen that?
I did, yeah. And
is that a big step? Like, where do you stand on that?
I think it's a pretty big step, yeah. I think that the Confederate flag is a very difficult piece to navigate around because not all people that wave the Confederate flag are racist by any means. I don't think that you can say that anybody that has a Confederate flag, you're automatically a racist, because it's not true, because I've seen otherwise. You know, I lived in Maryland, so I saw flags when I was living in Maryland. That's where I grew up. But a lot of those people that had Confederate flags, they weren't racist. They were just proud of their heritage, proud of the fact that they, you know, were in or near a Confederate state, and, you know, that's all it was. I do think it's a very divisive thing, though, and I think that it stirs up a lot of raw emotions for people that did not grow up with it. Right. And I can absolutely see why it would frustrate them, why it would upset them. And I think it's probably a good thing, honestly. I really do.
Here in Australia, we've seen stuff like, I don't know if you watched the show Little Britain, or like Tropic Thunder is the net, probably the next one, where people appear in blackface. Like, where do you sit on that issue? Like, do you watch that stuff and find that irritating? Do you want to see them expunge? What do you think?
I really love Tropic Thunder. You're talking about the movie with Robert Downey Jr.,
yeah,
right?
Downey Jr. And Jack Black and stuff.
I actually like that movie a lot. I thought he was very funny in it. And I've seen him do an interview with Joe Rogan on Rogan's podcast.
Oh, yeah, right.
And he spoke about it a little bit. And he was actually against it initially, and he knew it was going to cause problems. But he said he's, you know, spoken to a lot of his black friends, and they thought it was hilarious, and I actually thought it was pretty funny too. You know, I don't take it as something. You know, I don't take that as racism by any means. You know, I know he's not a racist. I know that movie. You know, the people behind the movie were not racist. I just thought it was funny, but. There's obviously a line that can be drawn between that and some other things that potentially have happened.
So, yeah, like your Al Joplin stuff.
In that specific case, no issue with that.
Okay. What about this one? The sorts of behavior that people are protesting against, they're protesting against here in Australia, predominantly sort of Indigenous deaths in custody. I'll ask the same thing I asked before, if it was a part of your life in the United States. Was it ever a part of your life here in Australia, first or second hand?
It actually wasn't.
Okay.
No, it wasn't.
Why do you suppose that?
I don't know. You know, I'm not an Indigenous Australian. Mm. You know, I'm a black/white mixed American. Right. So.
And even in that circumstance, you never came up against anything.
No, not that I can remember. I really didn't. I never remember any specific instance like that in Australia. You know, I know that it happens, you know, and I have heard some of the things that the Indigenous people there have been through. Mm. So I understand why the same type of outcry is happening. Absolutely. But did I see it firsthand? You know, did I experience it?
No.
I did not.
Oh, well, that's good. Is that rare internationally? Obviously, you had it in the United States. Did you have it? You've played in a lot of countries.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't think I've really had it anywhere.
Okay.
Maybe not even in Estonia. No, didn't have it in Estonia. Didn't have it in Russia. Turkey, I don't even want to talk about.
Why not? Turkey, you didn't enjoy.
Oh, Turkey's a long story.
Okay. Have you told it anywhere?
Turkey's an entire podcast story.
All right, I might just have to do that for you. We'll do that another time. My last question for you, Josh, and then I'll let you go. Is there ever a question that you wished someone had asked you about, you know, if it's about last season or something else? What's a question you've always been itching to answer but never been asked?
No, I don't think there is one. The only question that pops into my mind, Liam Santamaria actually did ask me.
What was that?
How the hell do you say his last name? I've known Liam for years, and I always mess up his last name.
Liam Santa Maria.
Yeah, that's what I thought, and that's what I said. But for some reason, occasionally when I say his name, I want to go to San Martino, and I don't know why.
You don't know San Martino.
Every now and then I say San Martino, and I catch myself, and I'm like, oh, shit, I did it again.
Both are nice-sounding names, but he asked you a question. What was that one?
What was the purpose of you making the post when you found out that Melbourne was signing Sean Long? Because I made an Instagram post
after
that.
What, if you don't mind saying it again, what was that purpose?
I said that off the record, actually, and I don't think that ever record.
Off the record.
I just wanted to make sure that the actual story was out there. Okay. Because I saw how Casper was treated after he left and went to Sydney, and I wanted to make sure the same thing didn't happen to me. I wanted to make sure that everyone knew what was going on. That's
cool.
Really, in a nutshell, you know, without getting into too much detail.
Yeah. You okay with me that leaving that in? Do you want me to cut that out?
No, absolutely. Yeah, you can leave that.
All right, cool. Josh, that's all I've got for you. I'll stop recording.
That's it, everyone. Thank you very much for listening. Before I go, though, I have 9 words for you. rate, review, subscribe, Booktopia, and see you next time.